Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest. And today, for Catholics, is the feast, the solemnity of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And that's a big one. And so we're off, actually. We pre-record this for you. And we got a good one. I can say that because I know all the questions already. Here at Catholic Answers, on the biggest feasts, we are off. And this is a big one. Each summer, in the middle of August, we remember the Assumption of Mary into heaven. She was taken into heaven, body and soul. Jimmy Akin, our guest, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, Teaching with Authority, A Daily Defense, and he's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cyril Kellett. And even though we get days like the Assumption off at Catholic Answers, there are some civil holidays that we don't get off to make up for that.
Yeah, I'm always here on Martin Luther King Day, which is not so bad because there's no traffic. Like there's a bonus to working on holidays because there's no traffic. And some of the other holidays we're here, but we're Catholic, so we take off the Catholic ones. And I will probably accidentally give out the number, but don't call today because all the questions have already been submitted. It's an open forum, but it's an internet open forum. Jimmy, even though it requires some time travel into the future, tomorrow, that is August 16th, I know you know what's dropping on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What can we expect?
Well, it's episode 325, and there's a reason for that. And we're going to be talking about guardian angels. And the reason we're talking about guardian angels is because I've gotten sick of answering questions about them.
Really?
Because lately there's been this whole spate of questions about guardian angels that people have been asking, and it's the same questions over and over again. It's gotten repetitive, and so I said, I'm going to create a resource, and in the future, I can just point people to that resource. Now, if they ask a question about guardian angels that's not in the resource, you know, something new and interesting, well, I'll answer that. But I got tired of answering, do we keep our guardian angel when we die and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Because that's just been asked so many times recently. And so I wrote a script about guardian angels where we talk about how the concept developed, what we know, what we don't know. And I arranged for it to be an easy to remember episode number, 325. That's the year that the First Council of Nicaea met. So if anybody has guardian angel questions, as of tomorrow morning, they can go to mysterious.fm/325 and get all their main guardian angel questions answered.
Well, congratulations on making it 325 episodes, too. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's actually more than that, but those are the main sequence numbered episodes.
And I have noticed that in my short time here, relative to your more than 30 years of doing this.
Oh, yeah. 31 thus far. Actually, 31 thus far.
Questions trend. Yep. There are these times when you go, oh, man, we've gotten that question so many times in the last few months. So I guess guardian angels, they're very popular. Which is good. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you need them. So I assume. I know I need one, but I don't know how you. Maybe you can navigate without one. Let's start with questions. Ray submitted this question: Is King Solomon in heaven after committing so much adultery and idol worship? If not, I know we don't know for sure. Then how can his writings be in our Bible?
Well, he did commit idol worship, but he didn't really commit adultery. I'm not thinking of any passages of that. He did marry a bunch of women, but that was not the same thing as adultery. His dad, David, did commit adultery with his mom, Bathsheba. But I guess there are a few things to say here. The first one is some scholars questioned whether Solomon actually wrote the books that are attributed to him in the Old Testament, though I do think it's likely that he had a role in them, particularly with the book of Proverbs, although at least on its surface, it wouldn't appear to all be by Solomon. For example, if you look in Proverbs chapter 31, it's attributed to an otherwise unknown king named King Lemuel, who, since he's got a different name, wouldn't appear to be Solomon, although kings sometimes had more than one name, and so some people have proposed maybe Lemuel is just another name for Solomon. We really don't know. In any event, one could, you know, he could and did write under divine inspiration when he was alive, but you still have free will while you're alive. And so one could, after writing under inspiration, go on to be lost at the end of one's life. That's possible. So the mere fact that someone wrote a book of the Bible does not guarantee that that person is in heaven. But I think in Solomon's case that we have some positive evidence. Now, Jesus refers to him in a positive way in the New Testament. He holds up Solomon as an example of glory, you know, finery, stuff like that. And so even though Solomon definitely had flaws and he got punished for them, he was also confronted by a prophet and told about, because of your flaws, this is what's going to happen to your house. And so it's quite possible that at that point he repented and shaped up and stopped committing idolatry and stuff like that.
Thank you very much, Ray, for that question and for getting us started. This one comes from RJ. Is it proper or correct to suppose that any significant suffering a person experiences, when offered up to God in prayer, might be rewarded by His grace when a person passes away in consideration of their salvation? Is there an article you wrote or something you read and liked about that?
So I don't have an article to point you to, but if a person voluntarily endures suffering, it will help purify him of disordered desires. Now, we're not talking about inviting suffering. That's a whole different thing. And sometimes that's meritorious and sometimes it's not. But if suffering comes to you in life and you voluntarily endure it and say, you know, Lord, if please help me through this, and I hope the way I handle this pleases you, then that will help purify you of disordered desires. And the fewer disordered desires you have at the end of life, the less you're going to need to be purified. So correctly handling suffering in this life will lead to a reward in the form of needing less purification. Also, God may reward the suffering that you undertook for His sake, you know, like standing up for people, you know, for the Christian faith when you had an option not to, but in order to stand up for the faith, you did. And, you know, that was another form of voluntary acceptance of suffering. God may give you an additional reward for having done something good. We're told that we will all be rewarded positively or negatively for what we did in the body, and enduring suffering for Christ's sake is a good thing. So that's one of the things that would get a reward.
All right. That was RJ. RJ, thank you for that question. That brings us to our first break. We'll be right back with more Internet Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
Human beings are God's greatest masterpiece. Every person is made in the image and likeness of God. But every saint, that is, every person who accepts God's invitation, His upward call to make them holy. And so every story presents us with a unique masterpiece that God is writing.
The Journey Home, Monday night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Okay, we're getting closer and closer. This being August 15th, we are very close now, just a little more than a month away from the big Catholic Answers Conference. We'd love it if you'd come. Scott Hahn's going to be there. Jimmy Akin is going to be there. And those are two of the people I would love to hear talk about the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. But that's not all. Kimberly Hahn will be there. Father Sebastian Walsh will be there. All of our apologists will be there. And it's almost like a bonus when you say Dr. Ray Guarendi will be there. He's always a great speaker and a lot of fun. And we'll do the radio show. It's September 26th through 29th, right here at the 10th Annual Conference, Catholic Answers National Apologetics Conference. Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Find out all about it and sign up at CatholicAnswersConference.com. Andrew's from Tennessee. And he asked this, Jimmy, what does the Catholic Church say about the salvation of those who, either because they were born too early or because they live in a completely remote part of the world, were unable to hear the gospel? I find it difficult to believe that a good Buddhist man living in 300 BC India would be immediately damned just because he happened to be born too early and in the wrong part of the world. Also, what does the church say about the noble pagans and teachers who lived before Christ, such as Buddha, Confucius, and Aristotle? Does the church believe they are divinely inspired, that they are treacherous and demonically influenced, or something in between?
Okay, so this is a question that comes up rather a lot, but the church has a fairly straightforward answer on this. The thought on this subject has changed over time, because when the church began, it was obvious to a lot of Christians there were a lot of people who were not Christian in good faith. You know, they hadn't heard the gospel. All the people who lived before the time of Christ hadn't heard the gospel. Jewish people before the time of Christ didn't know the Messiah was going to be Jesus of Nazareth and didn't have a clear understanding of what he was going to do. And there were pagans who had reasoned their way to God's existence. And so what you had was some of the church fathers said, look, what's important to God is that you're trying to live according to reason. And reason in Greek, at least in this case, is the term logos. That same term is used to describe Jesus in the Gospel of John, where it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the term for word in Greek here is logos. And so these like Greek philosophers who reasoned their way to God's existence and were trying to live a moral life, they were trying to live according to the logos, which Christians understand to be Jesus. But as John's Gospel says, Jesus enlightens every man that comes into the world. And so Christian early church fathers would say that he did that in the case of righteous pagans by enlightening them through the gift of reason. And if they tried to live according to that reason, then they were implicitly trying to live according to Christ. Well, then the old world got evangelized. And so by the Middle Ages, everybody was either in the old world, anybody knew was either a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew. And the idea was, well, if you're a Muslim or a Jew, you've at least heard about Christ and you haven't embraced him, so that must be your fault. But they still wondered, well, what about people who grew up on an island, you know, somewhere where they didn't hear the gospel? And there were speculations, well, maybe God would send an angel to tell them the gospel or something like that. And so it would be possible for them to be saved in that way. And then 1492 happened, and Columbus discovered the New World. And the New World was full of millions of people who had never heard the gospel, and most of whom had not had angel visits to tell them about the gospel. And that forced a reexamination of this question. And so, just like in the early church, where there was a recognition that if you were not a Christian through no fault of your own, it was possible for you to be saved, provided you met certain conditions, that element of early Christian teaching was essentially retrieved after the discovery of the New World. Because now it's not the case that everyone we know about has heard of Jesus. There are all these new people, they haven't heard of him yet. And so by the by the 1800s, it was recognized at the papal level that one could, if one is not Christian through no fault of one's own, one could be saved. And this was emphasized at the Second Vatican Council, which said that if someone otherwise, you know, tries to live a moral life and so forth, and, of, you know, to, and they're living up to, in essence, whatever level of light and grace they do have, but they're not Christian through no fault of their own, then they can be saved. When it comes to religious thinkers, the church does not hold that all non-Christian religious thinkers are demonic. In fact, it recognizes that there are elements of gospel truth in some of what they say. Like you look at Buddhism's Four Noble Truths, and they're, you know, like desire leads to suffering and things like that. Well, okay, there are elements of truth there. The problem is that Buddhism doesn't realize Jesus is the answer to the problems that are posed with the Four Noble Truths, but the Four Noble Truths themselves are not really a problem. And so beginning in the early church, these elements of truth that we find in non-Christian teachings were referred to as seeds of the gospel. And they're things that historically evangelists would point to as common ground, you know, to build a relationship and with people who believed them and then evangelize them about Jesus Christ. We see St. Paul doing that in Acts 17, for example, when he speaks at the Areopagus in Athens, and he actually quotes from pagan poets and truths that the pagan poets acknowledged as a way of building common ground in order to preach Jesus Christ. So we see a mixture in non-Christian religious teachings of truth and error. That's not to say that demons had no role, but and some non-Christian teachings are just flatly in contradiction with the Christian faith. But we need to sort the good from the bad and not just label things, oh, this is all good, because no, it's not. Or, oh, this is all evil and demonic, because it's not. We need to sort the good from the bad.
Andrew, thank you very much for that question. It's an Ask Me Anything this hour with Jimmy Akin, but it's an internet Ask Me Anything. We've got all the questions right here in front of us. This one comes from Ryan. I recently saw a quote showing Archbishop Vigano saying good things about the Pope, but I don't understand what did he do that irked the Vatican to the point of excommunicating him after finding him guilty of a schism charge. Did he let his attachment to the Latin Mass and his displeasure at the Pope's 2021 document on that get the better of him? Or is it possible this situation is being blown out of proportion?
So the first thing I'd say is the Vatican did not excommunicate Archbishop Vigano. It ruled that he had excommunicated himself, because if you commit schism, that triggers automatic excommunication. So he excommunicated himself. That's what they ruled. I prefer not to speculate on what leads people to do things unless they tell us this is what led me to do this. And as far as I've seen, although he has an appreciation for the traditional Latin Mass, I haven't seen anywhere that he's said that the restrictions that Pope Francis put on the traditional Latin Mass were what led him away from the church. Instead, I've looked at his writings, and this has not been blown out of proportion. Here's what Archbishop Vigano has said. One thing he said is, as I stated in my communique of June 20th, I do not recognize the authority of the tribunal that claims to judge me. That's the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. Nor its prefect, okay, so that's Cardinal Fernandez, nor of the one who appointed him. So that's Pope Francis. So he's just said, I don't recognize the authority of Pope Francis. Now, the definition of schism is a refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff. And if you say you don't recognize his authority, you're in schism. This is open and shut. He went on to say, now, he said it, he committed a schismatic act in that first statement I read sort of implicitly, but later on in the same document, he says, before my brothers in the episcopate and the entire ecclesial body, I accuse Jorge Mario Bergoglio of heresy and schism, and I ask that he be judged as a heretic and schismatic and removed from the throne, which he has unworthily occupied for over 11 years. So he thinks that the Pope is a schismatic and a heretic beyond. And so, okay, it's clear he is refusing submission to the Roman Pontiff, and therefore it is very clear that Archbishop Vigano is in schism and triggered an automatic excommunication and therefore excommunicated himself.
Thank you very much, Ryan, for that question. Let's go to a question from Hugh. Is Revelation chapter 12 a good proof text?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to prove. Different people try to – Revelation 12 is an entire chapter, and so there are any number of things you could prove with it. Since this is a Catholic show, I would assume that what you may be thinking of is trying to prove stuff about Mary in it, because one of the principal figures in Revelation 12 is a woman that John sees in the sky. And a lot of people have identified her as Mary. So could you use this to prove certain things about Mary? Well, in principle, yeah. But you got to be careful, because we know the woman's Mary because she gives birth to a child who is obviously Christ. You know, it said that this her child is going to rule the nations with a rod of iron and things like that. And so, well, Mary's the one who gives birth to Christ, so some aspect of this symbol refers to Mary. But one of the things you find when you study Revelation is symbols in Revelation can point to more than one thing. They're what's sometimes called polyvalent. And so you also see that the woman is clothed in the sun, is standing on the moon, and has a crown of 12 stars. And that imagery is drawn from Genesis, where Joseph has a dream about the sun and the moon and 12 stars bowing down to him. And the meaning of this dream is given to us in Genesis. The sun and the moon represent Joseph's father and mother, and the group of 11 stars at this point represent Joseph's brothers. And so this is imagery that signifies Israel as a nation. And so this the woman in heaven also seems to signify Israel. She also has links to Eve, because there's a conflict here between a woman, her seed, and a serpent. And that goes back to Genesis 3, which involves Eve. And it has a reference to the church. And so this one image of the woman seems to represent multiple things. And so the woman gets caught up to heaven, or she's given wings to be able to fly away from persecution. Could that, you know, reflect a doctrine like Mary's Assumption? Yeah, it could. Is it going to prove it to someone who doesn't already believe in the Assumption? Probably not. So I consider this text of being only limited use as proof text for Marian doctrines. I think it's better to try to, for the most part, argue Marian doctrines on other grounds besides Revelation 12, because of the ambiguity that's involved in the figure of the woman, and then which parts of what follows. That makes it hard to refer specific things that follow it in the text to an individual element. You could say, well, this applies to Mary, but you could also say, maybe that applies to Israel, or maybe that applies to the church, or something like that.
All righty. Let's see if I can get you another question here. Giuliano, what will happen to the relics when comes the resurrection? I'm not exactly sure.
Okay, I'll answer that question. Okay. Well, if you mean the relics of saints, we don't know what's going to happen when the resurrection happens. They may be reincorporated into the bodies of the saints who have been resurrected, or they may not. The Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith has noted that the resurrection does not guarantee that all of the same matter that's in our bodies now is going to be in our resurrected form. In fact, it can't be, because over the course of our lifetimes, we've got a ton of matter literally a ton that goes through our bodies and our cells, and it ceases to be part of our bodies. And so you can't say anything that was ever part of somebody's body is going to be part of their resurrected body. So we have to leave that as a mystery to God. It's possible those relics will get reincorporated, but if God chooses to do something else, we ought to respect that.
All right, Giuliano, I didn't quite get the question, but Jimmy understood exactly what you were asking. Thank you very much for the question. We're going to take a quick break. Before we go to the break, I'll ask you again, check out CatholicAnswersConference.com to find out all about the big conference that's coming up in just about 6 weeks from now, September 26th through 29th, right here in La Jolla. Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Find out all about it. Sign up at CatholicAnswersConference.com. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whyweearecatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Hey, if you have a testimony that you would like to share, I would invite you to share it with us about how Catholic Answers has affected your life, maybe the work of Jimmy Akin or one of the other apologists, something you heard, something you read, helped you or a family member. It helps us to have those recorded testimonials, and you can do that by going to CatholicAnswersLive.com. And just click the red testimonial button. Then you can say as much or as little as you'd like. And we are very grateful for anyone who takes us up on that offer. At CatholicAnswersLive.com, click the red testimonial button and leave your testimonial. Now that I read that, I lost my place of where we were. Who am I going to next?
Question seven.
Seven. All right, Chris, what was going on at this particular point in time in history, if anything, that led the Pope to dogmatically define the Assumption?
Okay, so Chris is referring to 1950, which was when Pius XII infallibly defined the dogma of the Assumption of Mary. And I don't know that I can say for sure, you know, but I can cite a couple of factors. One of the things that I've heard proposed, I have not verified this, but I've heard it proposed, that one of the things that led to the definition then was World War II, which had ended in 1945. That had been a huge traumatic event in Europe that was still very fresh in people's minds. The nations were rebuilding from World War II. It was a very dark time. The rebuilding from all the devastation that was wrought was very stressful. People had lost loved ones, there were tensions, and it was a bad time. And so I've heard it suggested that one reason that Pius XII decided to define the Assumption at that point was to give people consolation, to give a kind of positive note, something to rally around, something to appreciate that God had done for us to help lift people's spirits and encourage Marian devotion so that people would turn to Mary in the wake of this horrible tragedy and ask for her intercession. Also, Pius XII had a strong Marian devotion himself, and so presumably that would have played a role as well. But that's about as far as I can go with it.
Chris, thank you. Appreciate that question. It's an internet open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and Stephen asks this: what do you think is the most likely form of space exploration and colonization for humans? Would we build domes on Mars, terraform Venus, build large space colonies? What makes the most sense to you?
Well, just giving you my riff on those suggestions, I don't think terraforming Venus is foreseeable anytime in the near-term future. Venus is currently, and it didn't always have to be this way, but it's currently a hell world, and terraforming it would involve radical transformations in its atmosphere. And it's hard to see humans undertaking that anytime in the next 1,000 years. Also, there may be life on Venus. In fact, just recently I saw a news story about a couple of gases that have been discovered in its atmosphere that may point once again to the possibility of life in Venus's atmosphere. We had some indication of that a few years ago, and now we've got some additional evidence. And if it's true that there's life on Venus, we don't want to terraform it. We want to let that life grow and exist the way it is. Well, okay, so what about, you mentioned large space colonies, and I assume here you're talking about either artificial structures or things built into asteroids, but not on a planetary surface, like you mentioned domes on Mars. And I think large space colonies are a possibility. I'm not aware of current plans to build them, and one reason for that is that it's harder to survive if you're not on a planetary surface. To just exist in something that's a free-floating space station, whether it's built into an asteroid or constructed purely out of metal. It's possible, but it's not as easy. So I would view that as something that may exist within a few centuries, but it's not currently on the drawing board so far as I know. Then we get to domes on Mars. I think domes on Mars is a good bet. People are planning to do that now. Elon Musk wants to set up Martian colonies, which would involve domes, by the end of the century. And so I think that's a pretty good bet. Now, it may turn out, and in fact, there's some actually pretty good evidence, that Mars has life. I did a couple of episodes of Mysterious World about that, so you can check those out. But even if Mars does have life, which I'm rooting for, and I think I think it'd be great if it does, and we've got some evidence that it does, we could coexist with that. It wouldn't be like Venus, where in order to be able to live on Venus, we'd have to totally transform the environment. We wouldn't have to totally transform the environment on Mars. It's colder than it is here. It's got a thinner atmosphere than it does here. But if you build domes on Mars, it'll work. And so I think that's a likely future form of space exploration. Also, I expect that we're going to have limited human spaceflight of the kind we've seen before. There are exploratory missions planned to the moon and to Mars, manned missions to the moon and to Mars and to space stations, as well as short flights into space and what's known as space tourism. So I think all that's going to happen too. More ambitious things are also possible, but these things are what I think is likely to happen in the near future, say in the next century.
Hey, what a great question. Thank you very much, Stephen, for that. It is open forum, but it's of the internet variety. Jimmy Akin, our guest. All these questions have come to us via the internet. And this one, I recognize this name. We have taken a question before from Fwaffy McFwaffins. And welcome back, Fwaffy. My 15-year-old son, Luke, has a question. Okay, my question was, before humanity...
So Luke McFwaffins.
Yes. Luke McFwaffins asks this. My question was, before humanity committed its first sin, according to the theory of evolution, which I am assuming is true because we have seen it happen, if everything was in perfect harmony, however we define it, then why did animals have to suffer, consuming one another for sustenance? If that's how things were meant to be, suffering would be included in the world long before original sin even took place. And prehistoric apes before Adam and Eve would have had to suffer from this also. If suffering is from the devil, then why did it exist before original sin? The devil is a spiritual being that was probably created before the earth. So does that mean suffering is entrenched due to the existence itself? That is a logical consequence of existing.
Okay, so a lot of people have this idea that prior to the fall of man, everything in the world was perfect and in perfect harmony, and there wasn't any death and stuff like that. And that is not what Genesis teaches, and that is not what the church teaches. If someone wants to believe that, okay, more power to them, but it is not what the Bible or the church teach. What Genesis says is that human death entered the world through sin, not that there was no suffering and death before the fall. The way the imagery that's used in Genesis 2 and 3 is that God planted a garden in Eden, and he put Adam there to till it and keep it. So Adam's the gardener of Eden, and by keeping it, it means guard it. Because, you know, what's going to happen in any garden you plant is there's going to be bugs, and there's going to be birds, and there's going to be other animals coming in. And Eden is basically God's pleasure garden. So he didn't want bugs eating all the fruit on the trees. He didn't want birds doing that. He didn't want other creatures doing that. So Adam's there to keep the critters out. And Adam, while he lives there, has access to the tree of life. But if Adam's guarding the tree of life, guess who also doesn't get to eat it? The bugs and the birds and the other creatures. So this was a unique gift for man, that as long as man was in the garden, he would have access to the tree of life and be able to continue living indefinitely. And consequently, other creatures could and did die. And that's not a modern view. If you read, for example, St. Thomas Aquinas, he says that, yeah, before the fall of man, carnivores were still carnivores. You know, so lions still ate meat before the fall of man. What the fall affected was mankind, not all creatures. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church agrees with this. If you look at paragraph 310, it says, with infinite wisdom and goodness, God freely willed to create a world in a state of journeying towards its ultimate perfection. In God's plan, this process of becoming involves the appearance of certain beings and the disappearance of others. So some things evolve and some things go extinct. The existence of the more perfect alongside the less perfect, both constructive and destructive forces in nature, with physical good, there exists also physical evil as long as creation has not yet reached perfection. So we can look forward, hopefully, to a future, you know, in the resurrection, where everything will be perfect, but God willed that our world, including the portion before the fall of man, was in this state of journeying where there would be both creative and destructive forces, you know, as it's sometimes said, the death of one is the life of another. You know, if a lion needs to eat a gazelle in order to survive, well, the gazelle's death sustains the lion's life. And then, of course, when the lion dies, the microbes get to eat the lion's corpse, And then the microbes get taken up into the ecosystem, which develops plants for the gazelles to eat. So it's kind of like there's this, I don't know, circle of life thing going on. But that's meant to be in place until the world reaches its final perfection. So one can propose that with the creation of Adam and Eve, God gave them a paradisical environment, but the same wasn't true of all other creatures, including pre-human life forms or pre-human life forms that preceded Adam and Eve. So like Homo erectus, you know, yeah, Homo erectus was not immortal, didn't have access to the tree of life. And so Homo erectus would have experienced suffering and death and so forth. Even Adam and Eve may have experienced suffering prior to the fall. You know, they had functioning nervous systems, and the purpose of our nervous system is to keep us out of danger. So if Adam and Eve, you know, like stubbed a toe and it would hurt, you know, that would like keep them safe. They would learn not to, you know, not to stub their toes, not to trip over things, not to kick rocks and stuff like that. So actually, a lot of suffering has a good purpose. If you'd like more information about suffering and the role it plays in the world, I did a video at the Catholic Answers Conference last year where I talked about it, and it's on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. If you go there and you type in, if God exists, why do I suffer? Then I'll drill down in quite a bit of depth into the concept of suffering and the positive role that it plays and how it relates to God's goodness.
Thank you, Fwafi and Luke McFwaffins. Appreciate the question. That brings us right to the break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
He is honored by the Church as a bishop, a defender of orthodoxy, and a saint with the title of Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Ambrose of Milan was headed toward a brilliant secular career in the Roman Empire when he was suddenly chosen to be Bishop of Milan in 374. He proved one of the greatest bishops and homilists in the history of the Church. Above all, he is renowned for baptizing St. Augustine of Hippo.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and we've got lots and lots of questions from the internet. It's an internet ask me anything. And one of the nice things about these internet ones is there's a little curating of the questions. So we get all kinds of interesting questions, sometimes questions that people won't ask or just generally don't ask when they call. So this is a lot of fun. And today's the Feast of the Assumption of Mary. And that's why we have a pre-recorded show today, because it's a holy day. And now we have a question about the Assumption. This one comes from Rob. Why is it called Assumption when we are taught that the last thing we should do is assume?
Well, the basic answer is because words have more than one meaning. And so in one context, a word will mean one thing. In another context, a word will mean another thing. And so words aren't univocal. That means they don't just signify one thing. In this case, the term assumption, when it refers to Mary, is taken from the Latin noun assumptionem, which means a taken up, and Mary was taken up to heaven. So Mary was assumed. She had an assumption. However, the don't make any assumptions usage has a different origin. Now, it still comes from the same roots. Ad and means to, and sumere means to take. And so ad sumere means to take something to oneself. and Ad Sumeri then became Assumere, and that's where we get assumption from the verb. Or, well, okay, assumption is a noun form of it, but we get the verb assume from assumere. And it could mean a number of different things. So when did it get the specific usage of that is involved in the phrase don't make assumptions? In that case, assume means to take for granted without proof or evidence. You just take something for granted without having any proof or evidence for it. You're assuming something to be true when you shouldn't. When did that come into existence? In the 1590s. So it only goes back about a little more than 400 years. And so modern advice about not making assumptions is based on this recent usage, comparatively recent usage of assume, but it has other meanings too.
Thanks, Rob, for the question. This one comes from Taylor. Why don't you use my questions? That's Taylor's question.
Well, we use this one.
Take that, Taylor.
No, I also remember answering other of Taylor's questions before. There are a few questions that I don't use when I. But it's very few. Typically, they fall into two categories. The first are questions that I would have to do research to answer, you know, and I don't have an easy way to just look up the answer. So if I have to do a bunch of research, I may not use that question. The other category is smart aleck questions, where, you know, when I post and say, I've got a pre-record coming up, does anyone have any questions? Some jokers just can't resist putting in a smart aleck question, like, what is the airspeed velocity of an unladen swallow? Or, you know, which
I have
is
heard
a Monty,
that question before.
It's from Monty Python.
Yeah.
Or how much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? And every once in a while, I will actually answer one of those because, like, with the woodchuck question, the answer is obvious. As much wood as a woodchuck could chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood.
Yeah.
You know, that's an obvious answer. And every once in a while, I'll answer a smart aleck question like that. But most of the time, I delete them. And so people who post smart aleck questions are basically wasting my time. So I tend to not answer those. But beyond that, beyond things that would require serious research and just smart aleck questions, I use basically everything. And so if Taylor thinks I'm not using his questions, that's not true. I have been, and I remember answering some of his before. A complicating factor, though, is that I often don't know when these pre-records are going to air. Like, sometimes we record what we behind the scenes call evergreen episodes, which are episodes that can be that are meant for use on an emergency basis. Like, if we have a technical issue that prevents us from broadcasting on one day, or if a guest, you know, fails to show up or something, and we got to put something on the air, we want it to be new content for people. So we record an evergreen episode that we keep on the shelf. And actually, we usually have several evergreen episodes, so to cover all contingencies. And I don't know when those are going to air. So, like today, when I announce questions for this show, I could say, and it's going to air on August 15th. But a lot of times I don't know when they're going to air. And so I may be answering your questions, Taylor, just when you're not listening. I may be answering your questions in shows that are still on the shelf, you know, that haven't aired yet. But I'm not deliberately excluding your questions. I know I've answered them before, and I'll continue to answer them in the future.
Thank you, Taylor, for
that.
We've got time to get another question, and Peggy wants to know this. I take the doctrine of the assumption on faith, but find it difficult to understand. It's not in Scripture. Did she live in Ephesus or Jerusalem? Did she die, sleep, and then was assumed into heaven? Who witnessed this?
Well, there are competing traditions about Mary living in Ephesus and Jerusalem. And in fact, there are two tombs of Mary, one in Ephesus and one in Jerusalem. And so The tradition is just mixed. It is a common opinion that she died prior to her assumption, but this is not 100% certain. That hadn't been infallibly defined, and so it's possible that she was assumed alive into heaven. Although the common opinion is that she did die first and then was raised and assumed. We don't know for sure who witnessed her assumption, but there are early accounts that speak of it as being witnessed by the surviving apostles. So while the church has engaged its teaching authority infallibly and on this question that she was assumed, and so that's guaranteed to be true, a lot of the details surrounding it are open for discussion.
Thank you, Peggy. This is nice. We're ending with this hour, this first hour on the Feast of Mary's Assumption, with a lot of Mary and Assumption questions. And we have time for another one. Don't worry, though. As I say, we have time. I just mean till the break. We've got another hour of questions and answers with Jimmy Akin. So this one comes from Melanie. Where then is Mary's body physically? I trust and have faith in the Assumption, but where her body physically is puzzles me.
Well, the dogma holds that she was assumed into heaven, and so that's where her body is. Her body is in heaven, and sometimes we think of heaven as a purely spiritual place, but it has to at least have the capacity to receive bodies in some form, even if they're not spatially extended the way they are here on earth, because Jesus's body is also in heaven. So if it helps you think of it this way, Jesus's body is in heaven, Mary is with Jesus, Mary's body is also in heaven, just the same way Jesus's is.
Jimmy, I think I'm going to skip to another Mary question because the next one in line looks long and we only have a short time. So I'm going to go to Jennifer's question, and this is also about Mary. Why is Mary generally depicted with blue garments?
Well, Mary's also generally depicted wearing red garments. She's normally depicted wearing both blue and red. And there is symbolism to this. In Western art, red symbolizes human nature because of our red blood. Blue symbolizes divinity because the sky, where we picture God as being, the sky is blue. And so in Western art, you will commonly see both Jesus and Mary depicted wearing both red and blue, but in a different order. If you look at Jesus, the garment that's closest to his flesh is blue, and then he's got an outer garment that is red. And what that symbolizes is that Jesus is intrinsically divine. That's the blue garment that's closest to his skin. But he's taken on a human nature. That's the red garment that he has as an outer garment. With Mary, it's the reverse. With Mary, you see her garment that's closest to her skin is red, signifying she's fundamentally a human. But she has been graced with divine qualities, meaning, you know, holiness and stuff like that. And so she's wearing a blue outer garment to signify the graces that heaven has given her.
Wow, that's very interesting. It's, you know, sometimes as a Catholic, you probably see these things a million times, but you don't realize that there's all that symbolism.
Stuff.
Yeah, all that stuff. There's a lot of stuff to this Catholic stuff. Thank you very much, Jennifer. And it was nice to end this hour with lots of Mary questions, but we're just ending an hour. We're not ending the program. Jimmy's going to come back for another hour with us, and we will continue with the Ask Me Anything. It's an internet version of Ask Me Anything. All these questions have already come into us, so you can just sit back, relax, and enjoy the questions and answers. And I'll probably give out the phone number, but I won't mean to. Also, today is the Feast of the Assumption of Mary. So wherever you are, whatever your relationship to Mary is, today's the day to celebrate her and remember her who agreed, who said yes to God's call to bring the Messiah into the world, who carried him and mothered him and is the mother of God. So a wonderful day to celebrate. We're going to take a very quick break, and then we will be back with more. I know we've got questions about pharaohs coming up. I know we've got questions about scripture coming up. I know we've got all kinds of good questions coming for Jimmy Akin. So hang on. We'll be right back with more right after this on Catholic Answers Live.